Hey there, and welcome back to Crypto Clarified, Investing in the Truth. This is the podcast series where we'd come together from time to time to discuss the most captivating headlines and trends from the crypto space. My name's Benjamin Dean, and I'm director at WisdomTree's digital assets team. Today, I've got the pleasure of being joined by Aya Kantarovic, who is the co-founder and co-CEO of Fractal. Before we start the episode, social media shout outs. For those of you who are listening in podcast land, hit subscribe. And then if you share it on platforms like WhatsApp, share it with your friends and tell them to subscribe. Sharing is caring, and that's what nice friends do for other friends. You can always find me on the Bird app at Benjamin Dean. And if you're in the United States, join the wait list at wisdomtreeprime.com. You won't be disappointed, certainly in the coming month, because that's launch date. All right, in today's episode, we're going to be speaking to Aya about a bunch of different topics. We're going to kick off with an intro, hear a little bit about her very interesting background and what they're building at Fractal. We're going to talk a little bit about possible institutional activity and signs of it in the crypto space. It's a bit of a weird time now. We're halfway through 2023. FTX feels like a bad memory in the past. We saw a lot of platforms succeed and fail in the intervening months. And we're starting to see some interesting signs out there around new players are in the space. So we're going to think about that. We're going to talk at length about the evolution of Ethereum and the history of digital infrastructure or digital asset infrastructure. And always, we're going to finish up thinking a bit about the future, because we love thinking about the future almost as much as we love clarifying crypto on the show. Before we start, though, it's time for the shout out to James and Sam in compliance. Don't hit the 30-second button. People, this is the most interesting part of the episode. You don't want to miss it. Before I begin, I need to state the following. To clarify, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of WisdomTree and Fractal and subject to change. Anything we present in this podcast is not intended to be relied upon as forecast, research, nor as investment tax advice. Information and opinions expressed in this podcast are not a recommendation, offer, or solicitation to buy or sell any securities, and reliance upon them is at the sole discretion of the listener. Please remember, past performance is no indication of future results. All right, on to the fun stuff. Aya, hello, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me. Excited to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure on my side as well to have you. I'm looking forward to the discussion today. I'm sure it will be very, very interesting. To kick off episodes like this with guests, we usually like to start by asking about their background, how they got into the space, why, what they found interesting. Tell the listeners a bit about yourself and your background.
Sure. So my background, I'm a third time founding team member, started my career off in banking capital markets. Even before that, I actually wanted to become a diplomat. So international affairs is my major in finance, always interested in movement of money and people internationally. So started in banking capital markets consulting, and then joined my first startup, was the first hire of a company called Tegas, which focused on buy side equity research for TMT specifically. Before joining really into crypto, my first job, which was at Pantera Capital, I was on the venture side of the business. This was during the boom and bust of the 2018 ICO bubble. So really had a front row seat into all of the interesting projects that were happening at the time and the beginnings of really a lot of the DeFi summer wave, which I'm sure we'll talk about. And then afterwards, really had the itch to go back on the operating side of the business. And was part of the founding team of FalconX, built out their sales and trading arm of the business, and took the company from zero to over 100 million in ARR most recently, as well as leading them through their recent Series D fundraise last year. I think for me, very excited to have been on the CeFi side of things, but given everything that happened last year, initially starting with Luna and 3Arrows, and then obviously progressing into a snowball effect through FTX, I had a lot of concerns in the way which infrastructure was being built in crypto for institutions. And so I had the chance to transition out of FalconX in October and excited to have transitioned and joined Fractal as co-CEO, which I'm sure we'll talk about too.
Yeah, great. It's a very interesting background. We do tend to have a lot of people turn up on the show with some kind of international relations background for whatever reason, or political economy. There's something about this technology, perhaps because it's got global reach. If you mix that with an interest in something like finance, it becomes very obvious why you'd enjoy this kind of thing, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, for me, I got appointed with crypto in 2016. because my boss at the time was from Venezuela. And I know we were talking about your trip to South America previously, but you know, this was the adoption there was enormous and really obvious. And he had to make a purchase for family members using Bitcoin for specific textbooks. And so that's how I was initially acquainted with Bitcoin. But for me, what really made sense was Ethereum. I remember reading the Bitcoin white paper, and it was just really difficult for me to consume at the time. But the Ethereum white paper and the application of Ethereum and decentralized applications on top of it, and Ethereum as this decentralized software for money movement really made sense. And to your point, I think remittances, for me, I have family in Israel, and as well as other countries, and it made just immediate sense as to why you wouldn't pay 7+% in fees, in order to send money to and from different countries.
Yeah, with experiences like that, and it becomes somewhat obvious. I saw somebody on the Bird app the other day, someone who's incorrect, saying nobody cares about international payments, nobody sends money across borders, and so this thing has got no use. I was like, oh, wow, that's a big statement. So.
Yeah, the amount of money FX desks make, I think would definitely argue against that. But you know, it's still, and if you think even about like how FX is built and the bips that you know, these desks make per trade, over just conversion of money, just because of the monopoly they have over certain FX rates and banks and partners, it's really ridiculous. And so it makes the underlying cryptocurrency adoption reason so obvious.
So let's bring a bit to the future. I mean, you don't have to fully explain what you're up to now at Fractal, because I know our discussion later on will somewhat inform that as well. But how about you give the listeners just a very quick kind of overview of what you're building and why there?
Sure. So at a very high level, what we're building at Fractal is infrastructure for institutions to clear, settle, and margin digital assets on chain. And so what that looks like today is we're trying to solve for ways to bring capital back into crypto, especially after everything that happened last year, where you saw the largest withdrawal of assets from the cryptocurrency ecosystem to either self-custody or out of crypto completely. And so what that looks like in practice is we're creating these SMA accounts for lenders, by which a manager can deposit assets and deploy strategy. A lender has full transparency into the strategy that's being deployed and can underwrite the risk of that strategy. And for the manager, what we're doing is giving them the ability to cross margin that position against other positions in crypto, and really creating all of that in this on-chain ecosystem. So an example of that is, you know, we have a client who has $10 million, wants to buy ETH, stake it, and then make it delta neutral. And so what we would enable them to do is within this SMA account, buy ETH and stake it, let's say via Lido, you get staked ETH as your receipt token. And now you're able, where you also bring market makers on chain so that they're able to quote a forward using staked ETH as a collateral. So now you have this full delta neutral ETH basis trade on chain, and a lender can lever that up, being able to underwrite the risk. And again, the manager cannot move assets outside of that restricted trade itself. So hopefully that's the initial start of us being able to bring back capital into the space and size.
Okay, great. Thank you for that short explanation, because I hope now listeners will understand kind of where we're going and why with this episode. The next step is to just think a little bit about why the opportunity exists. And you already mentioned it just before, and that's because of incidents like FTX at the end of last year. It's probably also due to events during the year itself, but it kind of explained to listeners like where the market was at that point, what the implications of FTX were, in a bit more depth, and then like how that creates a need in the market or an opportunity.
Sure. So there's basically two really interesting statistics that really jump out at me on the institutional side. The first is if you look at March 2020, that was really where you started to see institutional capital in size enter on-chain finance. And so whether that was on Ethereum, you could track it in different wallet sizes. You could track it in terms of the assets that were being deployed on chain across different exchanges, whether international or on Coinbase in the US. So that was really when you started to see these institutional entrants in the market. And then the other thing, the other statistic that really jumps out is the deleveraging of the entire space. And that happened immediately after FTX around mid-November 2022, which created this large impulse of both self-custody but also massive exchange withdrawals. And so what led to that was a number of things. I think even if you, it's important to always like rewind and think about how this infrastructure was built in the first place. And it was very fragmented. So, 2014 is really when you started to see a number of these institutions pop up in the space. And it really started to look like very basic forms of exchanges and then very, small desks that were crypto native prop shops. Joined by a massive desk behind it. So a great example is DRW launched its crypto Cumberland desk and so forth. And all of that liquidity was really broken up. So for institutions to trade in the space was near impossible. I mean, it used to take a month and a half to onboard onto one of these platforms, which if you think about that now, I mean, that's just absolutely crazy. And so what you started to get then in, I would say like 2019, fast forward a little bit, you started to get these prime dealers. And so think Falcon X as a great example, or Togomi when they popped up, or smart order routers like the Coinrouts of the world. And really what their job was to create an easy way to find liquidity in the space for institutions. So the user journey now was far more simplified. And so it was much easier to trade, clear, and settle, get credit in the space. That was also the year that Alameda popped up, and then later FTX. And I mean, I think we all know the growth of FTX. It was just enormous in size leading up to their most recent $40 billion round of last year. But in addition to that, you had a number of other things happening in crypto. You had the DeFi summer of 2020, and then you finally had 2020, the year of institutional entrance into the space. So there's enormous amounts of volume at this point, and assets being moved in crypto. The problem, which I think we started to see the cracks in the infrastructure last year, starting with Luna and Three Arrows, was that there wasn't the right, whether it was compliance, whether it was rules and regs internally in these CeFi organizations that led to what I would call people problems. So it wasn't that the technology doesn't work. If you think about all the stress tests that the market has had on DeFi, if anything, I think we can all say, applications like MakerDAO and Aave Compound, these DeFi blue chips very much work. But the issue was that in CeFi, you started to see that, the way that these different organizations were built and structured had cracks in just oversight. Is really what I would simplify by saying. So, someone would be able to, on a piece of paper, say that my balance sheet is X, and that was enough for, a credit check. And then someone could also say, hey, the collateral that I'm posting here, I'm actually going to post it in many other places. And you started to get basically crypto archipelagos like all over again. And so, one could make the comparison that Credit Suisse was the FTX in the situation following Luna and Three Arrows. But that, really what happened was the same issues and cracks that you saw in traditional finance were the same people and oversight problems that you had in crypto. And so, Luna and Three Arrows was really the big crack that started to really unfold a lot of this for a number of different players. Then you had Celsius, Voyager. In the summer, obviously at that point, BlockFi was really struggling at the time, and then FTX was the final. After there was a number of market volatility, was really the final straw.
Can we unpack one of those ideas? And it's come up before in previous podcast episodes, but it's sometimes obvious to people just because of the way kind of the public discourse, things are all conflated as crypto. Anything that, maybe has even some exposure to one of these tokens or coins, that's crypto. And it's important to kind of segregate certain ideas because there are different components and they've got different characteristics. Could you just explain? And you've explained it for what the centralized or CeFi providers, their failings internally. But you also mentioned that a lot of the decentralized finance, DeFi platforms, which are applications for the most part, didn't suffer from the same failings. Now, that's partly because of the way they're structured differently. One is more reliant upon the technology than the other. It's another one because of the way in which the organizations are often set up, like the RFA companies and whatever sits behind Uniswap Foundation. So could you just unpack that very clearly so that listeners walk away and can understand like why those DeFi platforms survived under those conditions, whereas the centralized financial service providers did not?
Sure. So yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head in that crypto loves its nomenclature. And so we tend to use really big words to kind of umbrella things that really should be separated out. And so, you know, to your point, you know, the blockchain is really what these decentralized applications are running on top of. So that's the technology. And then the crypto is just the currency that's being traded in the same way that you have, you know, an equity stock or the Tesla stock that's being traded. So I would even just completely separate the crypto piece out. That's just the asset that's trading across these different applications or CeFi platforms. And then in CeFi, you have people. And people make centralized decisions that has, you know, nothing very separated from the technology. So if I think about what differs between, let's say, MakerDAO and a centralized counterparty, is that on the centralized counterparty, human beings are making decisions and you're reliant on them being 24/7. You're relying on them, you know, running through the right compliance checks on collateral. You're relying on them, you know, when you log into your, let's say, prime broker account and it says that you have $10 million, you're relying on that application webpage that your $10 million isn't being rehypothecated, isn't being, you know, it's actually there. And that number is really true value. And so there's a lot of reliance on people on the CeFi side. The beauty of these decentralized applications is that you're just relying on the technology, and their ability to do this in a peer-to-peer fashion is by over-collateralization. So really the biggest thing that happened here with everything across, whether it was Luna 3 arrows, is that there was a lot of volatility in the market, and you know, the way that collateral was managed was broken. And so you had, you know, in DeFi, the reason that it survived all of this was that you couldn't double, triple, quadruple count your collateral in different places because it got locked up. So in DeFi, how it works is that when, you know, you go and, you know, this is also why institutions can't really use DeFi today because it's very capital inefficient, is that when you go to, let's say, on Aave or Compound, you want to borrow assets in order to put on trade using leverage, you have to over collateralized depending on the asset, whether it's 120, 130%, and so forth, the asset in order to then take the borrow and deploy the strategy. In CeFi, these were under collateralized loans, but the collateral was being used surprisingly everywhere. So again, I think the beauty of DeFi is that the technology works. We haven't been able to find this really interesting medium, which is, you know, what we're focused on, which is almost like CDFi. So how do you allow for to have almost this like closed off ecosystem, or for people to actually know who the counterparties are on the other side, or for but still have the locked up features that, you know, the technology brings to the table without having this huge reliance on people?
Yep, understood. So you've got it's essentially a trade-off there between capital efficiency and reliability, almost, or stability is maybe another way to put it, which is a big trade-off, really. How does transparency play into that as well? I mean, when people see money moving around and they realize there's a problem, they're able to increase the collateral, right? Is that broadly how things work?
Exactly. So what was really cool was during one of the market capitulations of last year, there was a point in which there was going to be a huge liquidation on MakerDAO. And I remember this so precisely because, you know, we were on the desk, everyone was panicking in terms of how to hedge themselves in case this player would get liquidated, and it would create enormous amounts of volatility in the market. And you could see, you know, it's such an interesting experiment. You could see anonymous wallets trying to ping across all of these different applications, this, you know, person, in order to top up on their position so they wouldn't get liquidated. But what was the beauty of that, and as you mentioned, is that, you know, traders were able to hedge against this potential volatility event in a transparent way without necessarily knowing who the other counterparty is. I think, you know, privacy is very important, and obviously there's a lot being done on the ZK proof side. But at the time, currently today, even if you think about CeFi, if you know the amount of times we've seen orders get sprayed on exchanges, the amount of times that you've seen OTC deals happening, but get settled on chain, you know, in the same way as traditional finance across all these desks, privacy exists, but you know, the folks working the desks tend to know who these different counterparties are and how those assets are moving. And so really the ability of transparency here is less around like, oh, you know, I get to see how Joe Schmo is trading, but more around like my assets actually exist on this platform where I'm taking leverage so I can really underwrite the counterparty risk that I have. And I think the biggest theme of last year was I have no idea what my counterparty truly is. And I think one really interesting fact that I saw coming out of FTX was speaking to a lot of my former clients was US-based clients who would have never touched DeFi or anything on chain this year told me that I would rather take regulatory risk than counterparty risk because I just don't know how to analyze the counterparty risk of some of these centralized counterparties. Because you just, you know, if you look at everything that happened last year, I mean, when you started to peel back the layers, the things that were happening were so beyond what someone might have expected, that I think it really made this a big unknown.
Yeah, the situation, it's very interesting there where you could contrast like the characteristics of one very open, digitally native, relatively fluid system that's actually quite conservative given its collateral requirements. And then you compare it to all that other activity where, yeah, who could believe how little due diligence was being done, the kind of like leverage long positions on such a volatile asset class, positions people were taking. It's almost kind of like that kind of setup is almost the opposite of what I understand you folks are trying to do. You're trying to square basically the benefits that the DeFi infrastructure gives you with kind of benefits of a correctly managed, compliant, above the board kind of a service provider, which a lot of these companies last year were not. You've just mentioned now regulatory risk is something that's reared its head and of all, you know, auspicious weeks for us to be talking, this particular one involves Binance and the SEC. That's all still kind of coming down. Well, but those kind of developments are still occurring. Are you seeing much then in terms of like when they say I want to take regulatory risk, not take counterparty risk? Are they basically saying I'm looking for a kind of regulated above the board venue in order to get access to these kinds of products and services? Or are they saying I'm sitting on the sideline? And regulatory risk might materialize, but I'm just going to sit here and wait it out. What's the kind of mood out there?
So there's definitely the I'm sitting on the sidelines, and I would say that's coming. But institutions is a very broad word. So I would say for the institutions that have a core business, you know, that had also a crypto desk, it's just not worth risking your core business at this point in time, at least in the United States, to punt within crypto. And so I think those are the institutions that you're seeing say, I'm going to sit on the sidelines and wait until we get some more clarity. And those were really the ones that came in 2020 as well, too, that are saying, okay, we're going to put a pause on this. Now, the ones that are saying I'm comfortable with that regulatory risk are, you know, these crypto native funds. And again, they'll vary anywhere between like 150 million in AUM to 500 plus. And they're the ones that are actually saying, I'm full in DeFi. Like I have no money sitting, whether it's on exchange or with a prime broker anymore, because I don't know how to measure that risk. And I think on the regulatory side, you know, there's a lot of geos that are coming out very strong, given everything that's happening in the US right now. And despite everything that's happening in the US, you're still seeing year to date that, you know, dollars within investment products in the United States are positive. And inflows have been higher than any other jurisdiction around the world. So I think that's still interesting. But if you're seeing where like and again, I'm just taking this as a measurement of thinking through like comparatively where assets are leaving or more so going to the sidelines, it's primarily a lot is happening right now in Canada. And then you're seeing again these institutional desks kind of pause in the US. in terms of actively traded strategies. Jurisdictions that have become really interesting in the past few weeks have been Hong Kong, as well as Singapore, the Middle East, and then UK too, which I'm sure you know all about.
Yeah, there's a lot of movement now in kind of the international slash offshore space. We've certainly seen with like the inflows around exchange traded products in Europe, there's been movement in the market across the market more this year than last year. And you're right, you've got to segment the institutional client base, so you can't speak about all of them in the same way. But there's more activity this year than there was last year. Interestingly, as you pointed out, this is the direction of travel as well. It does appear as though some of it is moving to places like Canada, Switzerland, of course, Singapore, as you say, Hong Kong, UAE. These are all, yeah, becoming kind of destinations that folks feel that they've got kind of from what I can see, they feel as though that the regulatory scene is stable enough that they're able to kind of manage that risk in a way that they can't do elsewhere. I guess it's just, you know, another piece of evidence that we're in 2023. The world's a big place and this technology is global. A lot of people are very mobile in the space as well, i.e. having a couple of nationalities or living in a few different places. So watching all of that play out in real time is super interesting. I appreciate your thoughts there from where you sit. I see similar things and it doesn't make me pessimistic. It's just different. If everyone was sitting on the sidelines, as a lot were doing last year, that's one thing. If there's a whole lot of companies blowing up, like Three Arrows Capital and FTX, that's another thing. But this feels, yeah, very, very different to recent times. In terms of, we've got some time left, which is great. Let's think a little bit about like how we can have a discussion that's informed about what the future looks like. And by that, I mean, you know, in prepping for this episode, we were talking through the different stages of Ethereum's evolution. And while we don't have to go through each of them in detail, it might be worth just quickly skipping through, given that you were there on the front line seeing it, right, over those years at Pantera. But just kind of like, I guess we could class it as four stages of Ethereum, because I think when we get to the end of the four, it'll give us a basis to think about where we think there's going to be opportunities in the future. So if you don't mind running them through, I guess starting with ICOs is the most sensible
Sure.
place, right?
Yeah, and actually, one last thought too that I'll say on the
Sure.
geographic piece is there used to, I remember when we started FalconX, all of the trading activity through the like mid to end of 2022 would happen in Asia hours. So we almost worked 24/7 because, you know, you wouldn't really start to see flow until, let's say, you know, really Asia morning. And then it switched to like US driven momentum based volume. And now you're actually seeing the pendulum swing back where you're seeing a lot of that volume comes Asia based. Asia's triggering a lot of market movement and momentum based volume. So it's yeah, it's been interesting. So it'll be cool to see you know how long Asia's driving flow funds there too. So last point there. But yes,
It's a good
as
one.
it pertains to, yeah, it is a good one. But it's definitely not good for folks who are working in the US who now have to work Asia-based hours, but it's an interesting data point. So with regards to Ethereum, so the four stages, I can kind of run through at a high level. It originally started with the ICO phase. And I remember this super well because you know if you look at all of the ICO specific funds at different venture funds, it really did have the boom and then absolute bust. And there weren't many ICOs that were successful in raising capital for their different decentralized applications. And however, you started to see that these applications still needed a way to raise money in a quote unquote decentralized way. And so this ICO phase, which really started activity on Ethereum because you know it was primarily retail led, it felt like a quick way to make a buck at the time. So it was really this huge pump and dump like crypto mentality, which obviously wasn't the right narrative for the space, but I think it basically used 40% of Ethereum's gas within 2017 to 2018, leading up to 2020. Then around that time, you also got CryptoKitties, which was a huge proponent of Ethereum's gas, and actually, quote unquote, broke Ethereum because so many people were using it. I remember I was using it. And it was really kind of the first application of later what you'll see with NFTs, which really touched basically these non-finance backgrounds and attract them into quote unquote crypto ecosystem. But for ICOs, you had CryptoKitties, and then you started to see the DeFi summer. So basically, ICOs were n clearly not a good way to raise money for these funds via these quote unquote IPOs. And you started to see the US also press charges against certain ICOs as securities. And so it was a big red flag of, okay, we can't do it in the structure. And so you started to see different forms of DeFi applications that were raising money through just almost this like marketing growth on their platform. So for example, during the DeFi summer of 2020, that's when you started to get the yield farmer. What that really means is you as an application, you wanted to raise money, and so you c would create this token, but as opposed to like airdropping this token to a number of different people in the space, random wallets, what you would do is you would say, okay, come and deposit your assets on my application, and I will give you 120% annualized yield or return on those tokens. That 120% would only live there for like 5 days until basically everyone would deplete the yield or this marketing budget and spend. And then the yield farmer, which is what we started to call them, would go and find the next new application that was using their marketing budget. And so that was initially how these companies raised money, but that's really where you started to get the DeFi blue chip. So applications that you see today that have really held out through multiple market cycles. So MakerDAO, Compound, Aave, Yearn Finance, Curve, Wind, and Convex, Balancer. It's really this idea of decentralized lending, decentralized trading, Uniswap, and decentralized exchanges, decentralized asset management, and then other forms almost of your financial buckets that started to pop up. So that was 2019, 2020. And then you got in 2021, this is the third wave of Ethereum. This is where you started to get NFTs. So again, going back to CryptoKitties, this is really NFTs was the first time outside of CryptoKitties that you had adoption of not again these non-trader backgrounds in crypto. So not just that, but also adoption for users that never touched Bitcoin and Ethereum before. So someone would buy an NFT and have no idea what Bitcoin and Ethereum was, which was not the case with CryptoKitties. And so the application there was huge. You started to get really net new users into the space. We see, now all of the big brands, despite, the market maybe being down, you're still seeing so much activity across big brands like Coca-Cola, Nike, and the amount of revenue that NFTs have generated for these different user or companies is really immense. So that's 2021. And then lastly, and I think what's really very, very interesting is stablecoins. So stablecoins, Tether has been around since 2014. Circle has been around also for a while. But really, you started to see when institutions came in 2020, that's when you started to see stablecoin adoption. And it was really just this idea of, wow, I have instant settlement. Wild, and it's funny because now what even I personally use app, my bank accounts, and it takes a week to transfer from one bank account to another bank account. The first thing that comes to mind is like, oh, I just want to use USDC, in this example. And it was just very obvious of tokenizing, the dollar and making it easy to transfer almost immediately, especially because crypto markets are 24/7 and the banking. You'd be taking massive settlement risk with weekends and overnight hours if you were to not settle instantly. And so stablecoins really help solve that at scale. So quick summary on four big highlights for Ethereum and kind of bringing us where we are today.
Great. Thank you for clarifying that. We love clarifying crypto on the show, hence the name. But also, it's hard to condense all of that information down into something so succinct. Four cycles, ICOs, decentralized finance, NFTs, and stablecoins. What I hope kind of jumps out at the listeners from Aya's recount of those events are a few things. One of them is lots of trial and error. So you do end up with these boom and bust periods. You do end up with this flurry of excitement and energy and money that goes in. And then over time, you find out what works and what doesn't. And from each of those four phases, we can point at survivors right now. We don't have to list them all, although I kindly mentioned some of them throughout her recounting. But at the end of the day, there are some that survive. That's the nature of kind of trial and error and entrepreneurialism, right? The other one is that there's lots there that just doesn't work and just weren't good ideas. And you've got to kind of deal with them as well. And I get the feeling that sometimes when I see stuff on in the media, it's like, it's very nice to go and point at, it could be the 5% of things that are silly, or the 1%, or even 20% that are silly, right? It's hard to go and find the 1 to 5% that are going to nail it. Funny enough, they're the ones who get the least publicity. It's because they're too busy working and they're not using their marketing budget to go and do double spread interviews. But like, they're the hardest ones to spot. And out of all of the survivors that I just mentioned, like, I think I caught one or two of them along the way. And that was through going and meeting the people working on the technology and building their companies. But it's when we sit here in June 2023, it's easy for folks to kind of write everything off and say, oh, well, it's, you know, that's it. It's dead again. But if we've learned anything from the four phases or the five cycles that Ethereum's gone through, that I just mentioned, that like we know that there's going to be stuff that comes out of this. And that's kind of the task at hand, thinking about where the opportunities are and seizing them, or at least building them, is even better. Because it's only by building things we push things forward. We're coming up on time. The future. We like to finish episodes thinking about the future. And given everything you've just run through, you're in a really great position to think about where opportunities lie. Now, we know what you're doing with Fractal. Super interesting. And you're welcome to kind of say where you think things are going there. Or if you just look broadly across the space, you mentioned the stablecoins are super interesting. I agree with you. I use them all the time when I'm overseas, because in some countries, that's what people accept. So I see that the same way you do, but I'm curious to any other things that you've got your eye on for the benefit of the listeners.
Yeah, I actually, one big theme that I've noticed over the past few months is that there is, to your earlier point around iteration and growth on the entrepreneurial side, there is a class of what I would call CeFi 2.0. So really builders, early builders of these centralized crypto finance companies that are now building the next iteration of what they think these products may look like. So I've seen it on the custody side, on the lending side, on the trading side. And it's really this very big class of builders that have years of experience being on the founding teams of all of these companies. And it's gonna be really, really interesting to see, I think, what this next phase of CeFi 2.0, or if you want to call it CDFi, is going to look like with all of that knowledge of how maybe not to build something, or what to look out for, or how to fix that specific use case. And that's what I'm most excited about. And to your point, I mean, building takes time. So, you know, whether that wave is going to take 2 or 3 years for us to see in practice, I still think it's going to be really that next, what drives the next wave of growth for institutions in crypto markets that I'm most excited about.
It's a good point, right? During those raging bull markets, lots of people just rush in, and you get kind of the opportunists who turn up late and see a quick buck, and they tend to be the first ones to leave. And the ones who are left at this point are usually like the really grizzled ones who are like, I'm not leaving. No, like I loved it. I remember back in 2017 meeting all of these people, especially in Lisbon. They were just like, I do this for the fun of it. Like, I don't have to get paid. This is just great writing software. And if we think we've come up with something smart, that ends up becoming things like Aave. But, you know, they wouldn't leave for the life of they're like, no, this is too interesting. What is great at this point now, and I think sometimes people forget when you have the exodus, that the ones who tend to be left learn through each of these cycles. So as you've just said, like I was through that cycle and that one, here's what went wrong and here's what went right. At some point, all that knowledge aggregates in certain people and they carry that forward. And that ends up actually kind of meaning that their kind of risk aversion, well, is their ability to risk manage risk actually over time and then seize opportunities gets sharper and sharper as they learn more and more. And also as they share within one another. And we know these open source communities love doing that. So that's a good point there. And one that probably is forgotten a little bit in amongst kind of the continuing regulatory enforcement actions that catch all the headlines these days. There's a lot of other stuff going on in the background. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we're right up on time now, Aya, but please, where can people find you on the interwebs?
Sure. So I appreciate you calling it the Bird app, but on Twitter, I'm Aya, A-Y-A underscore K-A-N-T-O-R, or my email is just aya@fractalprotocol.org. Thanks again for having me. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Oh, it's my pleasure. If people want to find out more about Fractal, where should they look?
Fractalprotocol.org.
Easy. There you go. Fractalprotocol.com. Is it just Fractal Protocol? I know people do fractal.protocol these days.
I know. We're going through a name change, so we
okay.
At least for now, fractalprotocol.org.
Well, it's, there you go. You'll find it. Use Google or ChatGPT.
The iterations of building. Right.
Well, I hope everyone found today's discussion useful and informative. I sure did. WisdomTree Prime, if you're in the US, join the waitlist, wisdomtreeprime.com. I'm on Twitter. Bird app at Benjamin Dean. A reminder, if you want any topics covered in future episodes, or if you want to find out more information, you can use the snail mail, cryptoclarified@wisdomtree.com. You know how to find us everywhere else on the interwebs. Let us know. We'd be happy to cover any topics you want. Thank you again for listening today, and we hope you have a great day.